El Dorado, Illinois. A small town, big on natural beauty, and populated by good neighbors. A shocking accident traumatizes the family of a prominent physician. And bad behavior breeds bad blood.
Any doctor is usually a pretty highly revered person. When you live in a rural area, that person is sometimes almost legendary.
A family is ripped apart. When you can't trust those that are closest to you, small town values turn upside down. El Dorado, Illinois is a tiny town of 5,000.
It's El Dorado. There were two people, one with the last name Elder, and they combined those two, and that's how they got El Dorado.
Southern Illinois is also known as Little Egypt. It's bordered by the expansive Mississippi and Ohio rivers. The floodplains are as fertile as the muddy Nile, so it was worshipped as a god that gave life. John Dale Cavanis is born here on October 15, 1925, and grows up during the Depression. It's a tough town in a tough time. His father develops the boy's resiliency by encouraging him to fight. But Dale sees the effects of poverty, neglect, and malnutrition, and decides, while just in his teens, to become a doctor. He also has a desire to make money. Dale meets Helen Jean Pierce, the stunning, elegant daughter of a doctor. They have an instant attraction, and Dale has a lot in common with her father. After 2 years in the Navy, he marries Helen. And her father, Dr. Pierce, hints that when Dale successfully finishes medical school, he may get a placement at the hospital Pierce intends to build.
It's clear Dale is a very gifted medical student at Washington University in St. Louis. He and Helen live very simply. In fact, they postpone having children until after he's finished medical school.
But despite the early promise of their marriage, just 3 years later, Helen surprises friends and family by demanding a divorce. She will not state her reasons. A mutual friend of the couple, Marion Newberry, comforts Dale and soon becomes his new flame. They get engaged and marry in October of 1952. Marion assumes her brilliant husband, who is interning in Baltimore, will aim for a top job on the East Coast. But he announces they're moving just a few miles north of El Dorado. Dale is returning to his rural roots. Dale's work at Hamilton Memorial Hospital wins him adoring patients. He's a success, and people are attracted to him. Dr. Dale and his wife Marion have their first son, Mark Dale Cavanis, born on October 15th, 1954. Their second child, Kevin Dale, follows in 1956. A third boy, Sean, in 1962. And then the fourth, Patrick, in 1966. Dale is offered a job in El Dorado by his ex-father-in-law, Dr. Pierce, and Dale accepts. His wife's family blames her for the split. Pierce is delighted by Dale's impressive qualifications for the hospital. Marianne is disappointed in her husband's choice of rural El Dorado, but she follows Dale's career. A doctor of his caliber in a small town is rare. A cult of Dr. Dale grows, and he's almost worshipped like the mighty life-giving Nile.
Dr. Dale Cavanis becomes known simply as Dr. Dale in the community. He'll do pro bono work whenever it's needed. He's often seen to be just very compassionate. He becomes tremendously successful, and in being successful, he makes a fair bit of money. What he does is he invests in things like cattle farming and even catfish farming. Dr. Dale has a reputation in El Dorado because of his intensity. He's seen as someone who can really go from 0 to 60 in an instant. But this is largely accepted because he's so well-liked in the community and he's so successful. But on the other side of it, he's also developed a bit of a reputation almost as a ladies' man, if you will.
Dr. Dale is caught in an affair. His indiscretion discovered by his wife, Marion. But he has more surprises in store for his wife. She learns that they're broke, as farming businesses are floundering. The family has more bad fortune. The Cavanis home burns down, and while no one is harmed, they lose everything and must move into a hotel, to be followed by a move into two trailers, while the insurance company settles a $100,000 claim.
Now, Dr. Dale really seems in no rush to rebuild at this point. His family even wonders where the $100,000 is gone. His father is furious that he's not making the effort to look after his family.
In 1971, Dr. Dale has an accident while driving drunk, and he kills a father and his 10-month-old child. Dr. Dale's sunny future is now in jeopardy. He pleads guilty to reckless homicide and is charged with driving while intoxicated, unlawful possession of a loaded pistol, and shotgun. He receives 2 years of probation and a $1,000 fine. His loyal supporters rally behind him.
I think he felt like he was mostly above reproach. He thought that if, you know, if he died, so be it. If someone else died, that's not his problem.
He's almost clinical in the way he refers to the accident, as referenced by the fact that he said, well, everybody has to die sometime. You would think that this kind of statement would kill a doctor's career in a small community, but Dr. Dale manages to get past it.
Dr. Dale's loyal patients see him more as a victim of unfortunate circumstances than a perpetrator of crime. His reputation is unsullied. But Dr. Dale's second marriage does not survive. Marion moves the boys to St. Louis, and in December of 1971, files for divorce.
From secondhand accounts, there were many allegations that he had both physically and verbally abused her, emotionally abused her for a number of years before she finally left him.
The children struggle in their new surroundings. Drugs are commonplace here. Mark and Sean, who most favor their father's looks, crave their distant father's approval. Mark drops out of school and goes back to El Dorado to work on his father's catfish farm. 1977. The whole family meet in El Dorado for Easter. But Mark is missing. Sean finds the body, dead by a gunshot wound, and police determine Mark's death is a tragic accident. Sean drinks heavily to deal with the trauma and heads out to Oklahoma, but without purpose, sinking deep into alcohol abuse. In December 1983, he returns home and enters rehab. Determined to show his independence, he rents an apartment in St. Louis. But he has trouble finding a job, and by December 1984, his substance abuse is back in full swing. Sean's neighbors notice a visitor entering his apartment. Shortly after, Sean and the mystery visitor decide to take a drive. El Dorado, Illinois. Predominantly white, El Dorado has the dubious distinction of being a formerly racially segregated sundown town where non-whites are not welcome after dark. Dr. Dale tends to the residents of El Dorado, delivering the babies, caring for the seniors, friends, and neighbors at their best and worst moments, and doing so with compassion. But the Cavanis family itself is troubled with affairs. A broken marriage. A tragic accident that Dr. Dale himself perpetrates. The accidental death of the eldest Cavanis son, Mark. And now, Dr. Dale's second son, Sean, is visited by someone who means him harm. Only 22, Sean Cavanis has shown no mercy. Murdered in cold blood. Two shots fired into his body at close range.
Who could have hated Sean Cavanis that much to have murdered him this way?
The day after Sean's unknown night visitor takes him for a drive, a farmer finds a body lying on its back with both arms resting parallel to the torso. There is no identification present, and the farmer calls police. The body of Sean Cavanis is identified by his fingerprints.
Autopsy report reveals cause of death for Sean was due to two gunshot wounds through the back of the skull. Friends didn't indicate that he was intoxicated, but toxicology reports do not lie and indicated that he had a very high amount of alcohol within his system.
It's inconceivable to friends and family that Sean should end up this way. He's described as being a kid at heart and a perfect gentleman. If anyone he loved was ever in trouble, he'd step up and be there for them.
No one can forget that it was Sean, only 15 at the time, who discovered the body of his beloved elder brother Mark, killed by an accidental gunshot wound.
I think there was, you know, scavengers had consumed most of the flesh on the skull, I believe, and some of the vertebrae and arms. Very gruesome scene. I mean, any scene like that would be awful, but I think that made it much more so.
Sean's been grappling with the trauma of that event ever since, and it's a tragedy that he's really become a lost soul. The execution style killing, combined with Sean's alcohol addiction and drug issues, would almost make it look like it was a drug deal or a robbery that went bad. These circumstances could indicate that the killer had no personal attachment to the victim, and they were merely motivated by money.
What kind of trouble was Sean in? And who visits him in his apartment that night? At the time of his death, Sean is dating a young woman, Tina Crowley of St. Louis. Their relationship is getting serious, and shortly before Sean's death, the two are discussing marriage.
Tina reports that it was Sean's dream to give his dad a grandson to carry on the Cavanis name. This detail seems benign on the surface, but ultimately, investigators will talk to anyone and everyone that was close to Sean to see if there was a motive.
Police conduct an investigation into the death of Sean Cavanis. They visit Dr. Dale's office and ask routine questions. Dr. Dale reveals he hasn't seen his son Sean in 4 or 5 weeks and that he was at a large Christmas party the night of Sean's murder. Dr. Dale is a public figure, and he won't be difficult to trace.
And witnesses have Dr. Dale celebrating the upcoming season. He was the life of the party.
The officer follows up with all the members of Sean's family. They recount their whereabouts and when they last saw Sean.
This is incredibly traumatic for friends and family, but every detail is important. Even the smallest detail could lead to a break in the case.
Neighbors in Sean's block are questioned about whether they saw or heard anything suspicious in the building that night.
The painstaking work can ultimately lead to a breakthrough in the case.
It's here, in the apartment building, that a mystery starts to open up. Investigating officers learn about suspicious activity at the apartment block. From an apartment window, two tenants notice a suspicious car cruising the area the night of Sean's murder.
And finally they thought, boy, that seems kind of odd. So they wrote down the make and model of the car and what the license plate was.
The officer gets a match. The driver of the vehicle is ID'd and the answer is unexpected. Sean's Sean Cavanis, son of a prominent local physician in El Dorado, Illinois, who has struggled with addiction, is found shot to death execution style. He's the second Cavanis son dead by gunshot wound. His father, known in their small community as Dr. Dale, is loved and respected by many, though he is known as volatile and has made enemies. On the night of Sean's murder, neighbors spot a suspicious car circling Sean's apartment block. They write down the license plate number and give it to police. Police trace the license plate and learn that the car belongs to Dr. Dale.
Dr. Dale tells police he hasn't seen Sean in over a month, and it's possible that he just drove by the apartment, but the neighbors have more to tell.
That night, the couple report that they hear two distinct sets of footprints leaving the apartment about 3 a.m. They also see Sean and Dr. Dale embrace outside the apartment, and they definitely recognize the well-known Dr. Dale. There's no mistaking that Dr. Dale is with his son, Sean.
He's caught in a brazen lie because a couple of very observant neighbors took the time to jot down a license plate and turn that information over to police. The family reunites to bury Sean, the second son to die of a gunshot wound. Only this time it's murder.
Kevin speaks lovingly about his brother Sean, but his father interrupts him and tells him not to make Sean into something he wasn't, and adds that Sean was an embarrassment to him.
There are all kinds of ways that people react to grief, from anger to sadness. There's just no way to predict what that reaction's going to be.
Police tell Dr. Dale about the witnesses who have destroyed his alibi and have him firmly placed with his son, Sean, on the night of his murder.
Dr. Dale sticks to his story that he hasn't seen Sean for weeks, and the fact that there are eyewitnesses doesn't seem to faze him. Police keep him in custody overnight so he can think about his alibi.
After one night in the cell, Dr. Dale is finally ready to explain what really happened. Dr. Dale reveals he did visit his son Sean at his apartment on the night of Sean's murder. According to Dr. Dale, father and son hit the Mississippi waterfront bars, drinking hard.
As an alarming disregard for Sean's alcohol problem, and police have to be concerned about that.
And the story gets stranger. Dr. Dale says, while driving past some fields, Sean asks him to stop the car because he wants to look at cows. Dr. Dale indulges him. Dr. Dale says, Sean asked to see his .357 Magnum, and Dr. Dale gives it to him. Then he goes back to his car to get a soda. It's then he hears Sean cry out. According to Dr. Dale, Sean says, "Tell Mom I'm sorry." He pulls the trigger and shoots himself.
That story accounts for one bullet, but not the second. Dr. Dale explains that the idea of Sean committing suicide would have destroyed his mother, Marion, so he decided to stage a robbery scene.
Dr. Dale says he grabs Sean by the belt, removes Sean's wallet, rolls him over onto his left side, picks up the gun, backs off two or three paces, and shoots a shot in the back of the head.
He was 22 when he was killed, and then the age of the son in the second murder also was 22.
Well, investigators are shocked by the fact that a father could shoot his own son even after he's dead. But police have come to know this about Dr. Dale, that he is cold and almost clinical when dealing with these types of situations.
Dr. Dale tells police where they can find the wallet and other evidence, and the items are retrieved. Dr. Dale says he puts the gun in his car behind the driver's seat and uses a towel to wipe off his son's right hand to remove powder burns. But then an important detail resonates with police investigating the case, and it connects to the death of Dr. Dale's other son, Mark. Dr. Dale Cavanis claims he hasn't seen his son in over a month. But Dr. Dale is caught in his own lies. Dr. Dale confesses to police that he covered up his son's suicide to make it look like murder, to spare Sean's mother pain. But when police find out that 7 years earlier, Sean's brother Mark is also found dead of a bullet, both brothers dead at 22, they decide to look into Mark's death, which was deemed accidental at the time. Perhaps it was not an accident after all. Police call Kevin Cavanis on December 13th to tell him that his brother Sean has been shot dead. Kevin blurts out that he can't believe the nightmare is happening again.
That's not an answer most people would give when they would be told a family member had been shot to death. So that was something that really piqued that investigator's interest.
Kevin Cavanis tells police that in 1977, he lost another brother, Mark, to a bullet. Now both brothers are dead. Police decide to look at the case from 7 years earlier when Sean's brother Mark dies by a gunshot wound. Two brothers die 7 years apart, both age 22, both lost in shooting deaths. Police want to see if they can gain insights into the recent murder by looking at what happened to Mark Cavanis in 1977. Dr. Dale tells the police a bizarre story of a cover-up. But there's another possibility. Dr. Dale is a known philanderer. Rumor is he's had many lovers. He has a very strong personality and has made enemies. Dr. Dale may have made the wrong person angry. Someone out there could have a grudge against the Cavanis family. Dr. Dale could be hiding someone that no one, as of yet, can imagine.
The term Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde is probably overused this day and age, but that was truly a comparison made in news articles at that time. By all accounts, he was very easily angered when he was in a bad mood.
The divorce of his parents has a profoundly negative effect on Mark, the eldest son, and he drops out of school. This doesn't go over well with his high-achieving father, who considers him a no-good pot smoker. Dr. Dale's ex-wife Marion has telephone conversations with her ex-husband that are diatribes against Mark. Mark becomes depressed. Still, Mark keeps trying to earn his father's love. After the divorce, Mark moves back home to work for his father and becomes a permanent farmhand at the catfish raising operation. Though some say Dr. Dale treats Mark no better than any hired hand. still, Mark keeps trying. And he's excited to bring the entire family together again for Easter in El Dorado in 1977. But when they arrive, Mark is nowhere to be found. His family looks for him.
Sean is excited to have them all together again, but it's strange to him that Mark isn't there. What's even stranger, though, is what his father says.
Dr. Dale tells them that he has a feeling deep inside and is sure that Mark is dead. True to Dr. Dale's prophecy, they find the decaying corpse of their eldest brother lying near his truck.
The actual body, unfortunately, was outside of the truck, and scavenging animals had heavily damaged the corpse and had to be confirmed through dental records. They knew it was him when they found him.
Police surmised that Mark took a single gunshot blast to the chest when he pulled the barrel of the gun towards himself.
Because of a lack of evidence, the death is deemed accidental.
Some facts would not have held up to scrutiny by today's standards. Had they had the ability to process DNA at that time like they do in 2002, probably wouldn't have stood up in court.
But Kevin argues against the fact that the coroner ruled it an accidental death because Mark was far too experienced with firearms to have ever handled a firearm in that way. However, there's no other theory that could be proven.
Just months before Mark dies, Dr. Dale takes out a $40,000 life policy in Mark's name, naming himself as the beneficiary.
One of the first things you have to look for in a homicide is always motive. And in this case, there's a clear financial motive for Dr. Dale, who stands to gain $148,000 from Mark's life insurance policy.
Police find that previously Dr. Dale convinces Sean and Kevin to take out insurance policies as well. The doctor himself pays the $1,000 monthly premiums, insisting that he will use it as a tax deduction to offset his income. Based on the police's suspicion of Dr. Dale's involvement in Mark's death and his lies about not seeing Sean, Dr. Dale is arrested and charged with murder.
Well, the town is taken aback and reels when they hear the news that Dr. Dale's been arrested.
Dr. Dale has touched so many lives in his community. He's their doctor. He sees them through their entire lives. Everyone is convinced that Dr. Dale couldn't possibly do this and that he must be innocent.
Well, the sense in the community was this was a man who had been framed for murder. That was the general consensus for a lot of folks.
Well, it's inconceivable to many in the town that this father of four, this well-known, well-liked, compassionate doctor, would take the life of two of his sons. It's a travesty of justice as far as they're concerned. Or is it?
Dr. Dale Cavanis, who has devoted his career to serving his rural hometown of El Dorado, Illinois, is accused of murdering two of his own sons. Years earlier, Dr. Dale's family stand beside him when he is found guilty of reckless homicide, driving while intoxicated, and unlawful possession of a loaded pistol and shotgun. To his loyal patients, Dr. Dale is a victim of circumstance. Now back in court, again, no one can believe Dr. Dale is capable of filicide. His family doesn't want it to be true either. But the time has come for them to share their intimate knowledge of the man so affectionately known to the community as Dr. Dale. The trial for Dr. Dale Cavanis for the murder of Sean Cavanis begins on July 8, 1985 in St. Louis. Dr. Dale's supporters are there in person for the trial.
going to be very hard for the prosecution to convince a jury that a respected citizen such as Dr. Dale would murder his son in cold blood. So what the defense team is going to try to do is highlight that Dr. Dale was an extremely sympathetic and caring father to his son, Sean, who suffered from emotional problems and addictions issues.
The blood splatter indicates that there was no way that he would be able to have the dexterity to give himself a single gunshot wound to the back of the head. The second gunshot wound indicated that it was at least 12 to 18 inches from the body.
Dr. Dale's incredulous version of the night of the death is put to the jury, but the forensic expert provides some illumination.
What likely happened was Sean was unaware of the surrounding environment, perhaps maybe because he was under the influence. A single shot to the head behind him, fell down, and then received another one. The forensics examiner said without a reasonable doubt that Dr. Dale had committed this crime.
Police uncover that Dr. Dale's convincing of Kevin and Sean to take out life insurance policies so that the deductions would offset his income was a lie. In fact, Dr. Dale was hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. So there are some powerful conclusions to be reached here.
During an early wedding anniversary, Marion is apparently playful and in high spirits. When she shares with her husband that she prefers the idea of settling down in a major center and can't imagine living rural for long, her husband responds with a strike to her face.
Well, he claims he has no memory of the incident, so Marion lets it go. And it makes me wonder about why his first ex-wife wants to keep the details of the divorce a secret. Dr. Dale doesn't pay much attention to his sons except for abuse. And one time he, in fact, locked Kevin in a cupboard and then berated him when Kevin cried.
Stories are told about how he berates and beats the boys for showing what he perceives to be weakness or emotion. Humiliation is a normal occurrence. With the birth of his third son, Sean, in 1962, it is testified that Dale Cavanis becomes more dangerous. His rage increases. By their testimony, the beatings to both boys and their mother increase. Dr. Dale's desire for more and more money leads him to farming, and he comes up with a scheme to raise the biggest cattle in the world. But when the prize bull won't enter a trailer, Dr. Dale pulls out his .357 Magnum and shoots the $10,000 bull through the eye.
It's hard not to draw the comparison between the way Dr. Dale treats his livestock and the way he treats his sons, that something is more useful dead than they are alive. One would imagine that there is immense relief when Marion and the boys finally get away from Dr. Dale, but there's an underlying desire for them to maintain contact, and that will ultimately come back in ways that no one would ever realize.
Prosecutors believe that they have enough for a conviction. However, the defense moves for a mistrial on the grounds that a polygraph test was admitted into evidence when it should not have been. This motion is successful and a new trial is ordered. For this new trial, a pool of jurors is brought in from Kansas City to ensure that they're impartial.
St. Louis's top forensic examiner is brought in. He describes how Dr. Dale is guilty beyond a shadow of a doubt.
On the outside, it seems like an open and shut case. But for Dr. Dale, he doesn't like to not get his way.
For the second trial, Dr. Dale has a bit of a surprise in store. And that surprise is he's going to assert his right to cross-examine the state's medical examiner by himself.
Little Egypt, Illinois. If you stand on top of the bluffs, you'll see the combined Missouri and Mississippi. Dr. Dale has been like the king of Little Egypt. Will his formidable powers be enough to save him?
So he's going to attempt to use his medical knowledge and sway the jury with this know-how.
If there's any lingering doubt in the jury's mind about Dr. Dale's guilt, it's destroyed during the cross-examination. Dr. Dale shows no remorse for the death of Sean, and he's no match for the forensic expert.
There was a story, that was one of the top stories, one of the front page lead stories. It was what had transpired in his courtroom proceedings. It seemed like something ripped out of Hollywood to us living in, this rural part of Southern Illinois.
It takes the jury only 2.5 hours to reach their guilty verdict. Dr. John Dale Cavanis is found guilty of murder and is sentenced to death by the gas chamber.
And in fact, when I'd interviewed Jack Nolan, who again was the Illinois State Police lead investigator, he told me that had they had the science and the ability to process DNA at that time, they would have been able to pin him to the first murder.
Dr. Dale's supporters appear to be loyal right to the very end, and they doggedly refer to him as a hero, even as he's led away out of the courtroom.
Under Missouri law, any death sentence carries an automatic right of appeal to the state Supreme Court. So Dale Cavanis is actually not awaiting his execution date yet. What he's awaiting is his appeal hearing in front of the Missouri Supreme Court.
Dr. Dale, to anyone that has followed him, they're well aware of his violent mood swings. They must know deep down inside that ultimately justice has been served here.
Kevin Cavanis could have been the next target had his father not been found guilty.
I remember his son Kevin, who apparently passed away in 2013. He believed that there had been at least one attempt on his life by Dr. Cavanis, possibly a second.
One Thanksgiving, Kevin is in El Dorado visiting. And while staying in Dale's trailer on the farm, he awakes to find the door unlocked and all the oven gas burners turned on.
It certainly makes me wonder if he thought, wow, I got off so lightly, I'll bet I could get away with it. And then after the first one, I think that he really thought he could, another time around.
John Dale Cavanis makes no trouble on death row. But on the morning of November 17th, 1986, a guard conducting the 7 a.m. inspection finds his lifeless body hanging from a cell door. He's made a noose from 3 electrical cords.
Dr. Dale leaves a note for the prison guards, thanking him for their kindness.
John Dale Cavanis has an insurance policy and the money is left to his longtime girlfriend. Nothing to either of his surviving sons.
I think it's on a smaller basis, kind of the whole cult of personality. He was such a pillar of the community that he couldn't have committed those crimes.
John Dale Cavanis lives in a godlike manner, giving life and taking it away as he sees fit. His few remaining supporters focus on the loyalty they feel for the physician service Cavanis dedicated to El Dorado. For he truly is a Jekyll and Hyde, a man of good and evil.
Dr. Dale felt like perhaps you had a godlike status, where he had no regard for taking life, even within his own sons.
And as he sits on death row, he knows he only has one day left for his personal insurance policy to pay out. So he's sure to kill himself just prior to the expiration of that insurance policy. Only this time, he's not around to collect payment on it.